I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. I got squeamish yesterday reading David Quammen's new book, Spillover, in preparation for today's interview. He writes about a Dutch couple who ventured into a bat and python-filled cave in Uganda while on vacation. It was slick with guano and snakes that he said had grown large and lazy, living on a steady diet of bats. When they got back home, the wife became ill with what felt like the flu and later led to organ failure, hemorrhage, cerebral edema, and finally death. She had contracted a virus after spending just 10 minutes in that cave. David Quammen's book is about infections that are being transmitted from animals to humans, including HIV/AIDS, West Nile, Lyme, hantavirus, SARS, and more. David Quammen is an award-winning science writer, a contributing writer for National Geographic, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And a great pleasure, David Quammen, to have you with us on Radio Times.
Marty, nice to be with you here.
So was your goal to scare us to death?
No, not to death.
Near death?
Just to the brink of it. No, my goal is not to scare people. My goal is to convince people that this is a very important, very dire subject that should be understood, to help them understand it, and also to give them a reading experience that in some perverse way is enjoyable. I hope that this is a book of adventure and mystery and discovery, as well as a book of science explication and gruesome diseases.
Well, I would agree. It's all of the above. This woman, though, contracted what is called Marburg virus while she was in this cave in Uganda. What
right.
is Marburg virus?
Marburg virus is a filovirus. That's the family of viruses it belongs to. What that tells us is that it's a close relative of Ebola. So it's a really lethal virus, and we know that it abides in this large species of fruit bat. They call that the reservoir host. A virus that passes from animals into humans has a reservoir host, some species that's out there in the forest in which it lives inconspicuously, essentially harmlessly over a long period of time, having reached an accommodation with that species. So it's not causing disease in the bat, not causing disease in the reservoir host. And then occasionally humans come into contact with that animal, the virus spills over into the humans, and sometimes it causes mayhem in the humans.
Do we know how this particular woman, though, contracted this Marburg virus?
We don't. This is a really mysterious case. Well, we don't know how she contracted it. The husband, who I talked to, suspects that maybe she put her hand down on the ground as they were climbing over this uneven surface of rocks, touched some of the guano, and then maybe afterwards she touched her eye or she unwrapped a candy bar or a sandwich or something. But she did not get bit by a bat. She did not get scratched by a bat. She did not get hit in the face by a bat. She was only in there, as you said, for 10 minutes. She went home, and she had acquired the virus and eventually died from it.
He did not, though. He did not acquire the virus.
He did not.
And he has lived.
And he has lived. And he's been back to Uganda. He continues to try and help some of the development projects in Uganda, because he and his wife cared very much about mm-hmm. the people who lived in the villages, the children, people with health problems. So he has turned the death of her into a way of founding a program to support the people who really need health care in Uganda.
And are these people that are contracting Marburg virus?
Some of them, yes.
That live near this particular cave?
Yes, yes.
And you're as I said, I was very squeamish, but your description of this cave is really vivid. Were you in it yourself?
I was not in it. I was in some caves in the course of researching this, helping some people catch bats, but not in Uganda, not this cave. I describe another cave in Uganda that I heard about from a couple of CDC scientists who went in there looking for the same bat in order to try and confirm that that bat is the reservoir host of Marburg virus. And I tell the story of their underground cave explorations in the book, which are even more gruesome than the adventure tourism of this Dutch woman and her husband. Those guys are in their hazmat suits and their hoods and their helmets and their gloves and their rubber boots, climbing around in the dark up and down these cave shafts, and there are black forest cobras in this particular cave, not just pythons, and there are bats and there are ticks on the walls, and they're climbing through small cracks. They're finding dead bats and live bats swirling around their heads. trying to collect some bats that can be tested to see if they carry the virus.
So the bats in this case are the culprits, it's not the snakes?
The bats are the reservoirs. Let's don't call them the culprits.
Okay.
The bats.
I'm still slightly traumatized by this story,
We don't want to blame the bats. They carry this virus, and occasionally it spills from them into us. But the bats are not trying to get us sick.
They just happen to. But it's interesting that they're this reservoir host.
That's right. Yeah.
So does that mean that they have built up immunities to this virus?
Or? Presumably so. It's hard to prove that. But in most of these cases, the virus lives in a reservoir host in a state of accommodation. And the reason for the state of accommodation, presumably, is that the virus has been there for millions of years. And the reservoir host has adapted to the presence of the virus. The virus has adapted to the reservoir host in such a way that it lives there sort of inconspicuously. It replicates slowly. It doesn't cause mayhem. And then, as I say, when it spills over into a new host, the whole deal changes.
You write about bats. Besides being diverse, bats are very abundant and very social. Many kinds roost in huge aggregations that can include millions of individuals at close quarters. So we should really understand the bat world.
We should. And the reason I mention that is because there's a pattern. A lot of these new viruses that are getting into humans have their reservoir host in bats. It's not just Marburg. It's probably Ebola. We don't know that for sure. The SARS virus that spilled over in 2003 in southern China has its reservoir in a species of bat. There's a virus in Malaysia called Nipah, reservoir in bats. There's one in Australia called Hendra, reservoir in bats. So you hear about these things, and it's bat, bat, bat. Scientists are asking themselves, why bats? What is it about bats that they're the reservoir host in so many cases?
You were almost going to say culprit.
I was almost going to say implicated.
Okay. We have to be very careful about the language that we use. But we've done several shows about, at least in this country, bats dying.
White nose syndrome.
Exactly, white nose syndrome. So how does that factor into
different. But I did a piece for National Geographic on that subject. So I got into that a bit. It's very different. That's a fungus, as you know. It affects hibernating bats in the U.S. It grows on them during the periods when they are very dormant in their caves where they hibernate. And it's been devastating to hibernating bat populations in America. But the fungus doesn't infect humans. It's not a zoonotic disease. It's not a threat to humans at all. It's a huge threat to bats.
Indeed. And people should know what zoonotic means, because that's, in a sense, what your book is about.
Right. I guess we didn't introduce that. These diseases that pass from animal hosts into humans and cause mayhem are known as zoonotic diseases. And that's essentially what my book is about.
And the idea that a virus lives in an animal of some sort, and then through various forms of transmission, then can
get into humans.
Into humans.
And a virus that's living in an animal host and that gets into humans, we call it a zoonosis. If it causes disease, then it becomes a zoonotic disease. But it's worth mentioning, too, that some viruses spill over from animals and get into humans and remain sort of benign passengers in humans. There's one that I write about in the book because it has such a wonderfully gruesome name, simian foamy virus, SFV. And that passes from a certain group of primates in Southeast Asia, macaques, into humans when people have contact with these macaques that are the sacred monkeys in monkey temples, Buddhist and Hindu monkey temples in various parts of Southeastern Asia. I spent time with some scientists who were studying the passage of this virus into humans. Why were they studying it if it doesn't cause disease? Well, because it's like a canary in a mine shaft. It's an indicator for the fact that there has been contact, close enough contact, between these non-human primates and humans to pass diseases. And if simian foamy virus can be passed, then other more devastating viruses could be passed also.
But are we seeing more of these kinds of viruses that are passing from animals to humans?
Yes, we seem to. There's a continuing drumbeat of these new diseases, most of which are viral. And so scientists are asking themselves, what's going on? Is this getting worse? Zoonotic diseases are very old. It's an old phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Bubonic plague was a zoonotic disease, not a virus, but a zoonotic disease. The influenzas are all zoonotic viruses. So this phenomenon has been around, but it seems to be getting worse in about the last 50 years. Ebola, Marburg, Nipah, Hendra, SARS, West Nile, Hantavirus, et cetera, et cetera. So what's going on?
Exactly. Well, I mean, we are a certainly much more mobile human population. Is that a factor?
It's definitely a factor. And we are much more abundant. I know we have doubled our population size, what, twice in the last 50, 60 years? I think we have. We're at 7 billion humans on the planet now, headed probably toward 9 billion in the next 50 or 100 years. There has never been a species of large-bodied vertebrate animal on this planet as abundant as we are. So we're like a very, very dense, old, dry forest waiting for a spark to set it afire in terms of the potential for pandemic disease.
Are we an invasive species then?
Well, we are in a lot of ways.
That's, I mean, if we're growing at those numbers.
We are. We're weedy. We can live anywhere. We irrigate a large proportion of the resources to ourselves wherever we go. We cause a lot of disruption. You know, we're cutting our way through the Congo. We're cutting our way through the Amazon, through the forests of Madagascar, Southeast Asia, Borneo. We're killing the animals and eating them. We're building timber camps and villages. We're doing all this stuff that people have heard about, but they haven't heard about it in the context of something that, among the other problematic implications of that, is exposing us to new diseases, and it is.
And just to pick up on that, I mean, what you're saying is by cutting through forests, we are coming in contact with animals and what releasing, I don't know if that's quite the right word, but increasing the incidence of virus transmission.
We're increasing the opportunities for these viruses to get into us by contact, by close contact. I say somewhere in the book, you know, you shake a tree and things fall out. I mean that metaphorically, but also literally to a certain extent. You know, we're felling trees and mosquitoes and bats and other things are coming out of those, and we're getting exposed to the viruses that they carry. And then, as you say, once we pick up a new disease, because we're traveling everywhere, because we live in dense aggregations, our cities are big, there's a lot of interconnection, these diseases have the potential to spread widely, to go everywhere.
And we're almost up on a break here, but do you have to get bit or get scratched or in some way get hurt in order to get a disease?
No. It depends on the kind of virus. It depends on the situation, the disease. In some cases, it's a matter of them biting us. In some cases, it's a matter of us biting them.
Eating them.
Yes. Yeah. Ebola. There's a case that I talk about in the book where a whole village was racked by Ebola. Why? Because some young boys went out hunting. They brought back a chimpanzee. The chimpanzee had died of Ebola, and everybody who touched or ate the chimpanzee got sick.
That's David Quammen, our guest today on Radio Times. He's an award-winning science writer, author of a new book called Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Also, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. Any questions or comments? We'll be right back.
The Agnes Irwin School supports WHYY and is hosting an open house for all grades on Sunday, October 21st from 2 to 4 p.m. on its campus located at Ithan Avenue and Conestoga Road in Rosemont. With all-girls education pre-K through grade 12, families and prospective students are invited to meet students and faculty, tour the campus, and learn more about the Agnes Irwin experience firsthand. For more information, 610-525-8400 or online at agnesirwin.org.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're in the middle of the fall membership campaign here at WHYY. Have you made a pledge yet and become a member? Here's a special deal for you. Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist Tony Auth, who's a colleague here at WHYY, has designed a 25th anniversary mug exclusively for Radio Times. It features his trademark humor and drawing talents, and it's yours for a pledge of $60. Call 1-888-345-9499. Make that call, make that pledge, and get that mug. Thanks.
Holy Family University supports WHYY and is offering a graduate open house on Wednesday, October 17th from 5 to 6:30 p.m. at the university's Woodhaven site. It is an opportunity to learn more about Holy Family's graduate programs in education, counseling psychology, criminal justice, business, nursing, and accelerated MBAs, all designed specifically to help balance school with work and life. Now is the time to apply for a January start. Details at holyfamily.edu/YOU.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Our guest, David Quammen, says that a more mobile human population and changes in the ecosystem have led to more virus outbreaks, including an increase in animal-to-human transmission or animal-to-human diseases. His new book is called Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You write about viruses in here. You say, why so elusive? Because viruses are vanishingly minuscule, simple but ingenious, anomalous, economical, and in some cases, fiendishly subtle. That's what we're dealing with, right?
That's right, yeah. I mean, there are a number of different kinds of pathogens that cause zoonotic disease. Bacteria do it. Worms can do it. Fungi, protozoans. But viruses are the worst and the trickiest.
You write about something called the next big one.
The next big one.
What is the next big one?
This is something that scientists that I've talked to mention. I was talking to one scientist, and I said, why are you studying this particular virus? Actually, it was a simian foamy virus, a virus that doesn't cause disease. And I asked this scientist, Lisa Jones Engel, who was studying this this virus in primates in Bangladesh. Why are you studying it? And she said, because we're looking for the next big one. Mm. And what she meant was the next global pandemic, the next virus that comes out of an animal, gets into humans, and goes big.
Well, and I guess going back even to the flu epidemic of, what, 1919, was that the last big one?
Well, the last big one is AIDS. But the flu epidemic of 1918-1919, plant pandemic, killed 50 million people. And then people sort of forgot about that. You didn't hear it. When I was growing up, you never heard that there had been a flu pandemic, killed 50 million people. And then there was some historical excavation that was done, and people started to realize this was worse than World War I itself. It killed many more people. So that was a big one. Influenza can go big. Even the flu pandemic of 1968 killed about 1 million people.
Hmm.
And then along came HIV, AIDS, 30 million deaths, 33 million people living with the infection now. So one of the reasons scientists study these diseases, including the ones that seem like little ones that don't kill very many people, is because there is this potential for the next big one. And they want to spot it before it gets to that point that AIDS got to, and we suddenly realized that people all over the world had this infection.
And I do want to get to AIDS, because your history of AIDS is frankly something I hadn't read before. But the idea of the next big one is that either you have a virus that's so unusual, mm-hmm. we don't have the kind of antibodies to fight it?
That's right. Yeah, these viruses are unfamiliar to our bodies if they come out of animals. So they get into humans, and they cause horrible symptoms. And what would characterize the next big one would be a virus that is high. It has to have two characteristics. It has to be highly transmissible and highly virulent. If it's highly virulent but not very transmissible, like Ebola virus, for instance, then that's not likely to be the next big one. But things like SARS and the influenzas can be both very virulent and very transmissible, usually because they pass through the respiratory route. They're airborne viruses. Ebola is not an airborne virus. So the next big one would probably be an airborne virus like SARS or like the influenzas.
And I guess with Ebola, it ends up killing the host, right, because it's such a virulent virus?
That's right. But that old thing about, you know, the first rule of a successful parasite is don't kill your host is not really true. I mean, we've all heard that, but the real rule is don't kill your host until you've had a chance to get on to another host. Then you can kill your host. So the thing about Ebola is that it passes only in bodily fluids. It doesn't pass through the air. And so it's very devastating to people in villages in Central Africa where there aren't the tools and the skills for modern healthcare. People get this get this disease. They take care of one another. When their loved ones die, they clean the bodies. They don't protect themselves with latex gloves and masks and things like that. When you do that, then you can stop Ebola. It's much harder to stop the airborne viruses.
You write about, as I said, HIV/AIDS, and even take it back about 100 years to when it looks like a human being ate an infected chimpanzee.
That's right, yeah. And this is based on important work, fascinating work, that's just been published in the last 5 years by a couple of scientists that I interviewed, Beatrice Hahn in Alabama, Michael Warby in Arizona, and their colleagues. They have determined to a very high degree of confidence that the initial spillover of the pandemic strain of the virus that became the AIDS pandemic occurred in the southeastern corner of Cameroon in Central Africa, a relatively small area, in the early 20th century, probably before 1908, give or take a margin of error. And they can say this because of evidence developed from molecular phylogenetics, looking at different strains of the human virus, of the virus as it exists in chimpanzees, comparing them and saying, here is the match. That's where it must have come from.
But what's interesting and in the end tragic is that if it goes back 100 years, it seemed to go underground until the 1980s, and that was the beginning of the AIDS crisis.
Right. One of the things this tells us is that it simmered very quietly for a long time, for decades and decades, probably in the villages of southeastern Cameroon, and where its reproductive rate was very low. It was barely maintaining itself. People were not infecting one another at a very high rate. It didn't explode. It just sustained itself. And then it got down the rivers of Cameroon and Republic of Congo to the main stem Congo River, got to the big cities of Brazzaville and what was then Leopoldville, capital of the Belgian Congo. It's now the city of Kinshasa. Mm-hmm. And when it got to those cities, it encountered different circumstances, different sexual mores. People were having more sexual relationships. There were also injectable medicines. People were reusing needles in clinics to treat various kinds of venereal disease, and the reuse of those needles inferentially may have helped to boost the reproductive rate, and the difference in sexual mores certainly would have helped too. So once it got to the cities, then it started to grow in magnitude and in the speed of its reproduction. And we know it was in Kinshasa in 1959 and 1960 because we have some pathology specimens that were screened and turned up HIV positive retrospectively. And then it got from Kinshasa to Haiti with Haitian professional workers probably who went home to Haiti after having spent a period of time in the early independent Democratic Republic of the Congo, and then from Haiti it got to the U.S. and to the rest of the world.
A cautionary tale, would you say?
Yes.
But and do we know who this individual was that ate an infected chimp, or how the chimp got?
We don't. We can't know that. That's unknowable. But they refer to that scenario, which is the most likely scenario for the origins of the pandemic. They refer to it as the cut hunter hypothesis. They know that it got from a chimp into a human. They don't know how. They hypothesize that a person killed and butchered a chimpanzee for food, and in the course of doing that, maybe, presumably it was a man, cut himself and got chimpanzee blood into a cut on mixing with his blood and acquired the virus that way. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, though, to compare then the 1918-1919 pandemic, which killed, as you said, 50 million people in the course of a year or two, and AIDS, as much as millions have died from AIDS and many have contracted the disease, it is a much more slow motion.
Exactly.
Is it an epidemic? I guess it is, right?
A pandemic.
Pandemic.
Yeah, both of them were pandemics, but pandemics of very different kinds of viruses with very different results. Both of them killed about 30 to 50 million people, but influenza moves very quickly. Mm-hmm. And HIV moves very slowly.
And that's David Quammen, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. He's an award-winning science writer and, in fact, is a contributing writer to National Geographic. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY, covering a lot of territory, including bats and Ebola and HIV, AIDS, and SARS as well. Let's see what Alexandra from Unionville has to say. Alexandra, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. Yes, we live on a very large old horse farm, and behind each one of our shutters resides numerous bats, and there is a plethora of guano sort of around the perimeter. And I have always advocated for the bats because I know they're good for insects control, and I sort of feel sorry for their maligned reputation. And my husband kind of sees them as a vector for disease. So we've not done anything to displace them, and I just sort of wondered what the risk-benefit analysis is of this dynamic.
Alexandra, thanks for calling in the Radio Times.
Yeah.
David Quammen,
thank you, Alexandra. That's a good question. It gives me an opportunity to say, let's don't demonize bats based on all of these horrible stories that I'm telling about these viruses that come out of bats. It is important to recognize that they play a very essential role in ecosystems, controlling insects and, in some cases, pollinating plants. Bats have a bad reputation. They have a PR problem already, and here comes this guy writing about all these diseases carried by bats. I try to make the point that we shouldn't consider them the villains. They are they're playing an important role in the ecosystem, and there are not very many diseases carried by the bats that we have in America. I mean, if you were in Central Africa, then I would say, well, be very careful about Marburg, be very careful about Ebola. You need to be careful to a certain extent because bats can carry rabies, another of those old familiar zoonotic viruses. But by the same token, bats are doing a lot of good on your property. I would say, don't expose yourself too closely to them or to their guano. But don't worry about them too much either. You may have deer mice in that same barn that are carrying hantavirus. There are things out there, but the world is a big and complicated place, and we shouldn't be too concerned every time we look at wildlife.
Alexandra, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You mentioned hantavirus, and it seems like that's a virus that we, largely live with?
Yes.
Coexist with?
Yeah. For humans to become infected with the disease, at its worst, they call it hantavirus pulmonary syndrome because it affects the lungs. It's fairly rare. But the virus is not rare. The virus, there's quite a number of different kinds of hantaviruses. And the one that you hear about mostly in the Western U.S. at least is called sin nombre, the virus without a name. And that's the one that famously spilled over in the Four Corners area back in 1993 and killed a number of people. And that's the one that has recently killed three people who had visited Yosemite National Park this past summer and stayed in some cabins that were contaminated with bat droppings and seem to have gotten it there. But these cases don't occur very often, and yet the scientists that I talked to in the course of researching the book showed me data that that the virus is out there in some populations of deer mice. One in five mice is carrying the virus, 20% prevalence. So it's out there. It's fairly common, and yet it's not making people sick very often. That means it's probably not very infectious, or the mice aren't shedding a lot of virus. So it's another signal that we shouldn't panic about this. We do live in the vicinity of these viruses in many cases without getting sick at all.
We had mentioned, or you had mentioned SARS virus, and there seems to be a potentially new strain of SARS virus that showed up this summer.
From the Arabian Peninsula.
Exactly.
Right, yeah. A SARS-like virus, it belongs to the same family. It's a coronavirus. And it is not a precise match to SARS, but it somewhat closely resembles SARS. It killed one man in Saudi Arabia, and then it infected a Qatari man who was evacuated to London. And as far as latest I heard, he's still in a hospital in London. So that's only two cases, one of which was fatal. Why is it in the news? It's in the news because the scientists who watch this say anything that looks like SARS could be very serious. So they're watching this particular new emergence like hawks.
Well, and because SARS, as you said, is transmitted through respiration.
That's right, yeah.
And even going back at about 10 years ago, when the SARS virus first appeared, and it was an individual woman coming from a part of China, took a plane to Toronto.
That's right, yeah. A 78-year-old grandmother. She had gotten infected at a hotel in Hong Kong because she was staying on the ninth floor, and there was a man who had come from southern China for the wedding of his nephew, and he had gotten infected in southern China. He started to get very ill staying in this hotel. He was coughing, sneezing. He may have vomited in the corridor. And people up and down that corridor of the hotel picked up the virus. And then they left Hong Kong. She flew to Toronto. Somebody went to Beijing. Somebody went to Hanoi. Somebody went to Singapore. And SARS got to all those places, and they started infecting their loved ones. They started infecting healthcare workers. So SARS had gone halfway around the world in a very short time.
It was, though, contained, or at least I guess it's been temporarily contained.
It was contained. It was contained. It infected about 8,000 people, killed about 900, meaning more than 10% lethality, which is very lethal. Right. But it spread quickly from one person to another. There was even a couple of people that they called super spreaders, sort of the typhoid Marys of SARS, who, including that man in the hotel on the ninth floor, who infected a large number of other people. But then scientists identified the virus, they characterized it, figured out what it was and how it worked, and they instituted very firm, intelligent measures of containment, of public health control, isolation of cases, and they managed to stop it. Some people, you sometimes hear people say, or I've heard people say, oh, well, SARS, that burned out, didn't it? No, it did not burn out. It was stopped.
But there are public health issues raised. I mean, I'm thinking of, I wasn't alive, but, 100 years ago, we got public health and sanitation. We dealt with water supplies, things like that. It seems to me this is also a public health challenge, not just, around the world.
Absolutely, absolutely. And when you look at that, just the pattern of SARS, the cities that it spread to, Toronto, Singapore, Hanoi, Beijing, those are all modern command and control cities with strong governments and a lot of resources put into public health. If it had gotten to Kinshasa in the Congo or some, I love the Congo and I even kind of perversely love Kinshasa, but it's a disorganized city. It's not a place where you could count on really strong modern public health measures containing a new outbreak. So the history of SARS could have been very different.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation and our callers as well. David Quammen is our guest today in Radio Times. He's an award-winning science writer. He has a brand-new book called Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. He's written several other books, including The Song of the Dodo. And we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Just a few open lines and much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Camp Hill Special School with day and residential options is a community committed to the care and education of children ages 4 through 21 with mild to severe intellectual disabilities. Camp Hill's curriculum includes music, art, drama, the sciences, life and social skills development, animal husbandry, and horticulture, hosting an open house at their Chester County campus October 27th. Details at camphillspecialschool.org.
I'm Marty Moscoane. We're in the middle of the fall membership campaign here at WHYY. Have you made a pledge yet and become a member? Here's a special deal for you. Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist Tony Auth, who's a colleague here at WHYY, has designed a 25th anniversary mug exclusively for Radio Times. It features his trademark humor and drawing talents, and it's yours for a pledge of $60. Call 1-888-345-9499. Make that call, make that pledge, and get that mug. Thanks.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. As part of a citywide celebration of Frank Furness on the anniversary of his death, PAFA is exhibiting architectural drawings of the Furness-designed historic landmark building. On view through December 30th, these rare drawings document the evolution of this historical building. More information online at pafa.org or by phone at 215-972-7600.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Talking with David Quammen, his book called Spillover is about infections that are being transmitted from animals to humans, including HIV, AIDS, West Nile, Lyme, hantavirus, SARS, and more. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Charlie from Gilbertsville to join us. And Charlie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
Some questions about a disease that's caused by a niche, which is a gnat, and it's infecting deer herds in Pennsylvania and many states, and now there's a crossover into cattle in the Dakotas. My question is, they are concerned about certain diseases such as wasting disease and so forth in the wild deer, but yet this virus, which the hunters will be going into the woods very shortly, and they'll be consuming the meat from the deer they harvest. Yet there's no real concern about it.
Well, Charlie, let me see what David Quammen is
saying.
Yeah,
well, I know about chronic wasting disease, Charlie. We have that in Montana. It's in deer and elk around the country. It's caused by a prion, which is a peculiarly folded protein that causes other proteins to fold. Is that what you're talking about, or is this a viral disease that's carried?
No. I apologize for interrupting. It's a viral disease caused by a gnat, and it will annihilate a herd of deer in 3 to 5 days. It has a death toll, and it's a virus. And
what's the virus called?
Well, I only know it by its call letters of EHD.
EHD.
Boy, maybe somebody else can call in and help us out. I'm curious about that, but I haven't heard of it.
Charlie,
it's three to five days, and they're dead.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and maybe we can Google it and see what we can come up with. And you can call as well at just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. We haven't talked about Lyme disease, and Charlie's call reminded me because he's talking about white-tailed deer. What do we know about Lyme disease?
Well, it's not a virus. It's a spirochete, a kind of bacterium. It can be a very nasty disease, but it's also a very common disease in certain parts of the U.S. It's passed to humans by the bites of ticks. Ticks are the vector. We don't call them the reservoir host, but they're the vector, the way mosquitoes are the vectors of malaria. And but it does have reservoir hosts. It is a zoonotic disease. It lives in small mammals, and it lives in white-tailed deer. And the ticks transfer it from them to us. Now, that causes some people to think that, well, we've got to get rid of these white-tailed deer. They multiply. We see them in the suburbs. We see them in the little woodlands of the eastern U.S., and there are too many of them. And therefore, we probably have greater jeopardy of Lyme disease. But there's been some very interesting work done by a scientist named Rick Ostfeld in Dutchess County, New York, and in Connecticut. And he has studied for 20 years the ecology of the Lyme disease system. And what he's learned is that the prevalence of the disease and the jeopardy for humans has almost nothing to do with the abundance of white-tailed deer. Mm-hmm. White-tailed deer have to be there, but it doesn't matter if there are very few white-tailed deer or a lot of white-tailed deer. What matters is the abundance of white-footed mice, because the baby ticks, the young ticks, which are small, low to the ground, they're not getting on deer. They're getting on these little animals. They're getting on white-footed mice, and biting the white-footed mice is what infects the baby ticks early in the tick life cycle. Then they fall off and they molt and they become adult ticks, and then they get onto humans or they get onto white-tailed deer. when they bite humans, they probably have been infected by a white-footed mouse, and they haven't gotten around to being on a deer yet. So the abundance of these little creatures, the white-footed mice, is what determines the likelihood of humans getting Lyme disease. And what determines the abundance of the little creatures, the white-footed mice, has to do with whether there's been a big acorn crop, whether your forest patches are small or large, what the level of biological diversity is on your forest patches. If you've got a lot of squirrels and chipmunks and raccoons and other
possums
and hawks and owls in a particular forest, then they'll be preying on the white-footed mice. There won't be that many white-footed mice. The other little animals don't carry Lyme quite so efficiently, and so you'll have a lower jeopardy of Lyme disease.
Interesting. So the diversity of the forest helps to tamp that down.
That's right, yeah.
EHD, epizootic hemorrhagic disease. Does that ring a bell for you?
Well, it sounds kind of generic. It's a new virus. It sounds serious. If it's devastating deer populations, as Charlie said, in 3 to 5 days, presumably it kills an individual deer quickly, not causing a population to crash in 3 to 5 days. But also, it doesn't sound like it's zoonotic. It doesn't sound like it's in this category of diseases that passes into humans. It's a problem, big problem for deer populations, but not a problem for public health.
And I guess his concern was that someone might go hunting and shoot a deer and then eat the meat, and that would concern him.
And it's possible that it could pass into humans, but it hasn't gotten onto my radar screen yet as a zoonotic disease.
Thanks for calling into Radio Times, Charlie. And you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Let's see what Eric from Medford has to say. And Eric, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, my question was regarding diseases on an international scale. At airports, we've gotten great at being able to detect things like explosives or any sort of chemical someone could be carrying. You talk about how diseases are caught by somebody in one country and then flown to another, and there's an outbreak. Where are we at being able to detect such things like that, at a security checkpoint or whatever on an international port?
Yeah,
that's a good question, Eric.
Very interesting question. Yes. Yeah, and that goes to some of the public health measures and constraints that we may expect to see in the future. I don't know if you've seen this in Philadelphia, but during some of the flu seasons, when I've been traveling to Australia and Southeast Asia, occasionally you walk through an infrared monitor as you come off the plane. And what they can tell as you step through the infrared monitor is whether you're running a fever, whether you're at 98.6 or maybe you're up at 102. And if you're at 102, they say, excuse me, sir, please step aside, come in and talk with us, the public health officials of the country you're entering. Now, I haven't seen any of that recently, but it is the potential thing that we may face in terms of dealing with the spread of some of these new diseases, the threat of pandemic. Remember, 15 years ago, you could get on an airplane anywhere in America carrying a pocket knife. You can't do that anymore. Right. In the future, you may not be able to get on an airplane carrying a virus.
Interesting. Do you, though, suggest, and I think we've all been in public transportation, whether it's an airplane or a bus or a train, and someone is violently coughing. And I always wonder and worry that things are being just spread around as we're reading
the
papers.
Well, they are. And it is possible that that a person who's coughing is maybe spreading virus. I don't want to make people paranoid. I mean, germs are everywhere. Viruses are everywhere. Bacteria are everywhere. We're constantly covered with them. We're walking through an atmosphere filled with and generally we don't get sick. The miracle of our immune systems protects us from most of these things. So people shouldn't go crazy. Still, coughing on an airplane, sneezing on an airplane, coughing in an elevator, this is one of the kinds of circumstance that spreads these viruses. 999 cases out of 1,000, it's not going to be spreading a disease to somebody or a new disease. But it's not impossible that that's the way it happens.
Let me see what Mark from Newark has to say. And Mark, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, David. I've enjoyed the conversation. I'm a professor at the University of Delaware, and I'm a virologist.
Hi, Mark.
And I actually teach animal virology, focusing on pathogenesis. Great. And I really wonder about these spectacular viruses like Cinombre and some SARS, that how much of what we see is actually due to variations in innate immune signaling among individuals as opposed to an inherent virulence within the virus.
Well, that's an interesting looking more at the humans than...
Yeah,
go ahead.
Well, tell us more about that, Mark. I think that's very...
Well, it seems like as we get sequences for the receptors for viruses, and these are like the patterned recognition receptors of the innate immune system.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So these are the toll-like receptors. It seems like they vary considerably individual to individual in terms of their level of expression. And all of these RNA viruses, ones like the HANA viruses, mm-hmm. and influenza and Nipah and Hendra, mm-hmm. and all these ones all have to contend with that because they go through a double-stranded RNA intermediate. So they always got to have to contend with the innate sensing and interferon responses. And it seems like in humans, particularly in toll-like receptors 10 and 11, there's a great variation. And we see it in terms of variation and susceptibilities to bacterial infections. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering about, you know, when you have these pulmonary syndromes, you have this massive inflammatory cytokine response that ends up being causing edema and killing people. How much of that is due to...
the individual
their particular
person.
Particular susceptibility.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Mark, let's take your comment. It's an interesting sort of way of looking at this
issue.
Yeah.
Well, so Mark, in the viruses that cause really really high rates of lethality, you know, 50, 60, 70%, like Ebola and Nipah, are you saying that the people who are dying are generally those who are suffering this kind of cytokine storm, and that
Well, for Ebola, for instance, yeah, that's what gets you. With influenza, like the 1918, that and H1N1 in particularly susceptible people, that's what gets you. Because it increases vascular permeability, and it causes an edema in the lungs. And the gas exchange surface is generally only one cell thick. And if it gets more than that, and if it gets a liquid associated with it, you just can't exchange oxygen for carbon dioxide in the lungs. And I'm wondering how much of that is specifically due to, you know, the viral interaction with innate immunity, but also in the variation of the individual.
Of the individual.
Because if you
human,
look at
yeah.
a lot yeah. of these viruses, the seroprevalence is usually higher than, you know, the incidence of catastrophic illness.
Well, Mark, let me take your comment and give David Quammen
a
chance to respond.
No, I'm going to give him the last word on this because he knows a whole lot more about virology than I do.
Well, Mark, I'm the slight outsider here, but nonetheless the host of the show, and I need to make sure our listeners understand, and we're almost up in a break here, but are you saying it's important to look at the individual, the human being, and to see their particular susceptibility to these viruses that we've been talking about?
Right, because we've evolved with these.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, there's a lot of viruses that we are always exposed to, and we've, you know, back as far as insects, there are ways of sensing when foreign molecules are trying to replicate within the cell.
Yeah.
We 99% of our infections get taken care of at that level, but in those that cause severe reactions, it could be, you know, part of this may be due to individual susceptibility,
sure, sure.
that there's an overexpression of something.
Well, Mark, I appreciate the call to Radio Times.
All right.
Yeah, thanks a lot. David, did you want to add something?
I was going to ask him, what are the implications for treatment?
Okay, and I'm sorry because I just cut the conversation
anyway,
off.
Thank
here.
You, Mark. Yeah, thank you. We appreciate that addition.
Indeed, and David Quammen is our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called Spillover: Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Even picking up on what our caller, Mark, just said, something that I bumped into that Anthony Fauci said, director of the Infectious Disease Center at the National Institutes of Health, and this was an article about the West Nile outbreak over the summer, and mm-hmm. he said, I think it would be an over-exaggeration to think that there are millions of viruses ready to jump on us and bring us back to the 14th century. That would be looking over a ledge that isn't there. Do you agree with Anthony Fauci about that?
Well, in this book, I try to channel the voices of scientific experts, and Anthony Fauci is not one of them, but there are a lot of others who have been saying in the scientific journals and to me in interviews that that we need to take this very, very seriously. Maybe there are not millions of viruses waiting to jump into us, but there is a high degree of scientific concern over over how many of these are out there potentially ready to cause trouble in humans. Some people, some of the scientists that I've talked to say that, you know, for every species of animal, plant, fungus that you can find in a tropical forest, there's likely to be at least one unique virus to that species. Most of those are harmless to humans, no doubt. But that still leaves the possibility of many, many being potentially harmful to humans.
You end your book, and I'm reading just a sentence or two here. There's one thing about outbreaks. They end.
That's right.
Meaning?
We humans are an outbreak population in an ecological sense. We have expanded. I said that there has never been a species of large-bodied vertebrate as abundant as we are on this planet now. Ecologists talk about humans as an outbreak population. This is not my editorializing. So we should think of ourselves in an ecological sense as an outbreak population. We have expanded to great abundance. We're claiming a great proportion of all the resources on this planet. And outbreak populations, as ecologists have studied them, go in cycles. They're boom and bust populations by definition. So we should entertain the possibility that we know that we're a boom population. We should entertain the possibility that we may be a boom and bust population. The other thing that the study of outbreak populations teaches, at least among insect outbreak populations, is that when they crash, they generally crash because of a virus.
And we're animals. I mean, it's important to remember that we're animals as we're having this discussion as well.
We are, yeah. We talk about these diseases as passing from animals into humans, but we should remember the Darwinian truth that we are another form of animal.
Well, on that note, David Quammen, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for
joining
us today,
Marty,
on Radio Times. And the book is called Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. For more information about Radio Times, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.